We're not going to White Collar Resort Prison. No, no, no. We're going to Federal Pound Me in the Ass Prison.
And welcome to Risky Business number 205. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine information security software. You can check them out at tenable.com. On this week's show, we're taking a look at the most devastating state-sponsored, planet-melting, child-eating, zombie APT attack the world has ever seen, according to Vanity Fair. Anyway, it is the biggest cyber attack in history. Actually, no. It's a fairly unsophisticated botnet comprising of 70 infected hosts, albeit targeted infections. It seems like the tech guys and analysts at McAfee did some interesting work in seizing control of a small targeted botnet, and then these sales bots, marketroids, and public relationomatrons got their hands on it and spun it way out of perspective with the willing help of Vanity Fair. We'll be joined by Sean Duker of McAfee, a very nice chap, to have a chat about some of the detail of this so-called Operation Shady Rat, which to me seems more like Operation Media Fail and Triumph of Sales and Marketing Pitch, to be honest. The media has spun this one way out of control, much, I am sure, to the delight of the PR and marketing team at McAfee, and much to the irritation of the wider InfoSec industry. More on that in a bit. Also in this week's show, we're joined by Marcus Ranham in the sponsor interview. Marcus is, of course, Tenable Network Security's Chief Security Officer, and he joins me to discuss the US military's new cyber warfare doctrine. You know, it's the one that officially and explicitly states that the US can use kinetic retribution in the event of a cyber attack. So, like, you know, doesn't that mean that Iran can, like, now legitimately go and airstrike a US nuclear refinery now? Yeah. Marcus joins us to discuss that a little bit later on, and that's actually a really interesting chat. But before all of that, it is time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, the charges against Jake Davis, the alleged member of Lulzsec, arrested in the UK, 18-year-old Jake Davis, who is alleged to be a topiary. The charges are piling up against him. He's alleged to have attacked Sony, and he's alleged to be behind the Sun newspaper hack and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, they're trying to pin all sorts of things on him, aren't they? Although I guess at least he's out on bail, which is definitely better than being stuck in the cells.
Yeah, and they didn't send him off to Gitmo, which is a plus.
Yeah, I guess no one's trying to extradite him. That's definitely an improvement. But yeah, it's interesting that they do seem to be suggesting that, you know, he was just the spokesman, not the real mastermind, which is kind of an admission that he is actually topiary and like they have got the right guy.
It would tend to suggest that they're onto something, wouldn't it? I mean, of course, we need to wait until this goes to court before we can definitively say anything. But there's been a lot of rumours going around that the real guy is some Swedish guy and this was some sort of elaborate setup. But, you know, it's rumour within rumour, circle within circle, so it's really difficult to know. But obviously, we'll be covering that trial as it progresses. In this next piece, this is kind of anti-sec, lulsec, anonymous related. A bunch of guys reckon they stole a whole bunch of docs from Mantech, which is a, you know, cybersecurity contractor to the US government. Word on the street is that they didn't actually get anything particularly interesting, and it may have come from an external contractor who'd done work from Mantech. Have you heard anything about this?
I mean, I read the info that got dropped with the actual torrent, but I didn't actually bother downloading the torrent and looking at any of the files. I'm not really sure what contents there was. There didn't seem to be a whole bunch of things that were really interesting, and it looked kind of like they had owned one particular box that happened to have some stuff on it that, you know, kind of smelt like a place where you dump files, or just somebody's box who had a cache of things. So, like, the idea that they'd owned an external contractor certainly sounds believable, but it's kind of hard to say without actually having gone through, you know, 400 meg of somebody else's stuff, which, frankly, I haven't really got around to doing yet.
Oh, interesting too. Just going back to the Sun hack, I'm wondering where those 4 gigabytes of Sun emails have gone, because, you know, Lulzsec at the time that they attacked the Sun made a lot of noise about how they'd found all of this really amazing stuff and we're going to leak it and we're working in conjunction with media outlets. Hasn't happened yet, which is kind of a little disappointing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I guess we'd all like to see News Corp's dirty laundry. But yeah, you're right. It has kind of disappeared, that story. And was it The Guardian that they were working with or something? But then, it was sort of trolling on Twitter with one of the journalists from The Guardian. So who knows what's going on there. And I guess, you know, with Topiary down, maybe there's no one to make the funnies on Twitter.
Yeah, well, maybe everyone's just decided it's a little bit too hot. Speaking of heat from the authorities, a Dutch journalist named Brenno de Winter, and I'm sure Dutch people everywhere are laughing their asses off because that's probably pronounced, you know, Fred Schnerkel or something. this bloke has apparently covered Black Hat and DEFCON over the last few years, but he's not going to be there this week because he's being charged with a raft of offences relating to his publicising faults in the Dutch transit chip card. I think this is related to publicising MyFair stuff. Did you get a chance to look into this, Adam?
Yeah, so he's been demoing flaws with the smart cards that they use with the Dutch transit system, which is derived from the original MyFair. It's like a modern variation of the MyFair. And he's one of the guys who was originally involved with the classic MyFair hacks, and indeed apparently actually gave a talk at Black Hat about it at some point in the past when the dudes from, was it Boston, got an injunction against them so that they couldn't present at DEF CON. He ended up doing the talk instead of them. So he's definitely pretty accomplished at talking about hacking RFID transit systems. But yeah, it's kind of concerning, I guess, especially for you, I suppose, seeing journalists, who are covering what really is a legitimate news topic and, you know, doing so in a way that, you know, seems pretty reasonable to me, actually getting the book thrown at them.
Yeah, I guess my approach would be to film someone else doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I wanted to demonstrate, fare evasion using a dodgy card, I'd probably be happy to stand behind the camera.
Yeah,
thus insulating myself from these types of situations.
Yeah, maybe that's why you're not in Palm in the Ass jail.
And why my iPad's never been seized at a security conference. Anyway, moving on. And apparently Andrew Ornheimer, a.k.a. Weave, is negotiating some sort of plea deal for his role in the iPad AT&T, user enumeration thingamabop. That's according to a piece that comes to us via CNET's Eleanor Mills.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that turns out, because, I mean, that was one of those cases where technically fairly uninteresting, but the guys were clearly kind of jerks, and I guess, by all accounts, Weave does seem to be a bit of a jerk. And I guess if they're going to go and plead rather than have it dragged through court, that's probably a good thing for everybody. But I suppose when you're facing, up to 10 years in jail, then, any sort of plea bargain you're going to make is probably going to help.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to get a custodial sentence for this because, being a jerk, not really worth prison time.
Well, no, you're right.
Yeah, and definitely. The whole system that, they were just using bloody device IDs, enumerating device IDs to pull down email addresses, I guess the only reason the authorities took an interest in the first place is because they were jerks about it.
Well, yeah, exactly. From a technical point of view, really uninteresting. And you would find this sort of bug, I would bet, in, how many different telcos, you'd be able to enumerate customers out of some crappy web interface. So, yeah, uninteresting from that point of view. And if they plead, maybe he will get away without actually being pounded.
Now, probably one of the most interesting news items of the last week or so is that pretty much something like 70% of South Koreans got owned.
Yeah, so there's some particularly large social networking site in South Korea called CyWorld, that's CyWorld, got themselves owned and got all their user information, password, and that sort of thing stolen. 35 million people, which is... That's a lot of user accounts. And I guess, if you're the guy who's got that particular set of data and now you have a password corpus for 35 million people from one country, that gives you a very powerful tool to then go and attack any other web presence, inside South Korea. So big, definitely a big deal.
Yeah, apparently 25 million of those users came from CyWorld, and I think the rest of them came from Nate, which is a search engine over there. And of course, as is the style these days, they are blaming China.
Yeah, it is very much fashion, isn't it? But who knows, right?
It's very, very hip. Yes,
yeah,
but all your South Koreans are belong to China. Anyway, moving on. And this little item from F-Secure's blog, Mikko Hipponen, posted this, that apparently, you know, we've theorized about Bitcoin mining botnets. And apparently they've spotted one. There's no comment really on how successful this malware is, but it uses Twitter as a CNC. So, I mean, come on, how much more hip and Web 3.0 can you get than a botnet that uses Twitter for CNC and mines Bitcoins on infected hosts? This is too hip to ignore, even if it's not widely distributed.
That would be pretty awesome. The only thing that could possibly make it better, perhaps, is if the actual, admin control panel, was a Mac application, I guess, with shiny buttons and stuff. Like, that would make it, I suppose, pretty hip. Maybe if you could buy the command and control system, admin interface, if you could buy that on iTunes and run it on your iPad, that would be more hip. But otherwise, yes, very, very hip, very now. And, like, once again, I'm not at all shocked that we're seeing a Bitcoin mining botnet. Although you really, you have to lash together a lot of CPUs to mine Bitcoins at the rate of one crappy GPU. So the question is whether or not these botnet operators are actually targeting people who have high-end ATI video cards, that would be interesting.
Well, it is funny too, because I saw a couple of stories where they quoted some people saying, look, basically these guys would make more money renting it out for DDoS than actually than actually mining Bitcoins. Now, here's a big news story that ran here in the Australian media. The head of Australian spy agency ASIO, David Irvine, has addressed business leaders and basically said, we're all getting owned, we're all getting owned, we're all getting owned. Left, right, and center, he described the internet as the biggest content distribution system in history, which is a very savvy way to sum it up, I think. And he really said some, he really came out and said some pretty alarming things that you and I and probably most people listening to this podcast already know.
Well, yeah, and I suppose that's the interesting thing about this particular write-up is that, I mean, this got mainstream press over here in New Zealand as well. Mm. The fact that someone of that profile is coming out and saying we are getting owned on a massive scale, much bigger than you think, to the mainstream press. So that is, I suppose, a bit of a change, because up until now they've been, pretty quiet about it. And you and I understand that, people get owned all over the place and you can't secure this shit. But to actually, have the head of ASIO come out and say that, Canberra is the soft underbelly of the Western Intelligence Club, implying that people are targeting Australia and New Zealand to get at Britain and the US because we suck, significantly more than, perhaps the US do. That's quite an interesting thing to come out and say. And sure, probably it's internal politics or, budget wrangling or something like that. But,
I don't think so, because I was surprised that he said that as well. He really did come out and say that, that Australia was a weak point and attackers were using access to Australian computers to leverage. Now, it wasn't really clear if it was leveraging access into US, UK, Canada and New Zealand systems through Australian systems or whether they were directly accessing intelligence stored on Australian systems. But I think that point would be deeply politically embarrassing to the government. So I was somewhat surprised that he was so candid.
Yeah, well, yeah, me too.
It's an interesting write-up, and if anyone is interested in looking it up, they can Google for the title, which is Australia, the Victim of Massive Cyber Espionage. It's by Dylan Welsh. Now, Wired.com has published an interesting story about the Federal Bureau of Investigation's attitude towards emerging communications technologies. They got hold of an internal FBI document that makes for some pretty interesting reading.
Apparently, the document covers a whole bunch of things, including emerging wireless technologies like 4G GSM or the LTE GSM, as it's called. And I suppose it makes sense, right, that the FBI want to be able to intercept all the latest hip and new communications and all the challenges around voice over IP and the increasing use by carriers of voice over IP in their backhaul. Like, it does have a bunch of challenges for the FBI, and they do need to be ahead of the curve in addressing it. But, it's interesting that this document has leaked, and I'm sure there'll be some useful insights in there for us, even if it is just a good overview of, where mobile communications are heading.
Yeah, the document was actually obtained by the Federation of American Scientists through Freedom of Information, and Wired is actually hosting a copy of it if anyone's interested. The headline that will allow you to find it is FBI Surveillance Geeks Fear, Love New Gadgets, and you can go and link through and actually have a read of that internal FBI doco, which I've had a quick skim of it. It looks, it's kind of interesting. Now, look, we're just going to run through some of this stuff very quickly. Of course, it is DEFCON and Black Hat time. over there in the United States. Most of this research we've already actually discussed on the show because it's been previewed by the researchers delivering it. First cab off the rank is a presentation into Chrome OS vulnerabilities, which seem to be all about your sort of web-style vulnerabilities and yada, yada, yada.
Well, yeah, I mean, Chrome OS, you know, is a browser operating system, right? Everything is a web page. So, of course, it makes sense that the web bugs that previously affected, you know, how you use a web application now affect your whole operating system. And, you know, that makes them a bit more interesting in terms of impact. So, yeah, not really a surprise there. And it's, you know, good to see that this research is being done now before Chrome OS really is being widely deployed.
Yeah, and they're talking about, you know, creating zero-click worms and stuff like that that can affect Chrome. So it is interesting research.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll obviously be hearing more of that, more about that in coming weeks, and there'll be more information on that.
And certainly the way it interacts with Android is also interesting. There's some areas where apparently you can push applications from your Chrome OS out into your Android app and back, your Android phone and back and forward. And that's an interesting tie-in.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of interesting stuff you can do with Chrome extensions as well. But people can go and research that at their leisure. Also, we've seen some researchers demo some fairly, you know, the types of attacks you'd be expecting to see demoed against some Siemens SCADA kit. You know, stuff, default passwords everywhere, really poor security, bad handling, the whole lot.
Yeah, well, it's inevitable, of course, that in a post-Stuxnet world, people are going to be looking more carefully at the implementation of SCADA systems. And you know, the fact that there are hard-coded backdoor passwords in Siemens SCADA PLCs, right, I guess is not something that we're surprised by. Although the presence of dancing monkey backdoors apparently is a new thing.
Dancing monkey backdoors?
Apparently there was there's a Easter egg in one of the Siemens PLCs, which has a dancing monkey and a German proverb that roughly translates to "all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy."
Nice. Very, very nice. You got to love
it. Who knew Germans had a sense of humor?
Yeah, yeah. Who'd have thunk it? With apologies to any Germans who might actually be listening. Staying with SCADA also, and it turns out you can actually go around and Google for vulnerable SCADA equipment, which is a little bit like, oh.
Yeah, well, you know, once again, like if you will make web interfaces to your power station, then inevitably Google is going to index it when you put it on the tubes, and then you're going to look like a dick. And you know, the internet is just a big place, right? There's what, like 1 billion, 2 billion things on the internet, or however many there are now that we're running out of IP addresses. It's inevitable that some of them are going to be power station control systems. And just don't be the three guys who are doing that.
Yeah, otherwise, like with passwords, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and stuff like that. Mm.
Yeah, you know, that just don't do that.
Now, also staying in Las Vegas, and Microsoft has done something very interesting here. Our good buddy Katie Masuris has announced that Microsoft will pay $250,000 for defensive security research. So we're not talking about a bug bounty here. We're talking about, hey, if you can invent the next, you know, the next big memory protection like ASLR or DEP or whatever, they'll give you $250,000 in cash and prizes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is, it's a nice idea, and it's nice to see them, you know, coming out and doing it, and, you know, it sends the right message. I don't know if it's necessarily meaningful, I mean, really, that we're going to see a, you know, a really whiz-bang, crazy new technique come out of this, right? I mean, something that was that awesome probably is worth more than $250,000.
Well, hang on. Think about DEP and ASLR. Where did they come from? They came from open source.
I agree they did. Maybe they should go give this $250,000 to the PAX dudes.
My point being is that the next one that gets uncovered, I mean, I don't know that this has to be exclusively given to Microsoft. I think this is more about creating, you know, good runtime protection and runtime mitigation. I think it's a really good initiative, basically, Adam.
Yeah, I'm not as down on it as you are. I mean, I suppose I'm inevitably going to be a bit more cynical about it, but no, I do think it's a good idea, and I think that it is a nice counterpoint to the traditional bug bounty of saying, you know, that we'll give you some thousands of dollars for attack methodologies, you know, giving us, you know, an order of magnitude more for defensive technology. I think does send a good message, and it recognizes also the asymmetry between the complexity of attack and the complexity of defense. And so, no, I do think it's a good idea. I'm just not sure that we'll see something huge and awesome come out of it. I think it'll be a bit of a fizzer, but no, still good idea. And, you know, much respect to the Microsoft crew for doing it.
Yeah, they're running it through Blue Hat. And I guess, you know, maybe we'll get Katie on the show to actually talk about it and find out what is exactly, you know, going to be eligible. and how it's all going to work. But I think it's an interesting idea. It was a week or two ago that we chatted about this research going into car controllers, you know, so you could actually get into cars and start them up and stuff. That's been demoed at Black Hat. They war tested, basically, to actually get into these things. And interesting research. It has been demonstrated. They weren't full of shit.
Yeah, that's certainly made for a good demo, I'm sure. You know, they unlocked the car door and then started the engine remotely, which is that's pretty badass. And you know, in terms of Black Hat demos, it's not quite as good as money spitting out of your ATM.
No, I was going to say, it's going to take a bit to top. It's going to take a bit to top Barnaby Jack's work in that area.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if the car's navigation screen was doing jackpot, had a screen saying jackpot at the same time.
Maybe if the car actually asked you where you would like to go.
Yeah, and then drove you there under control of SMS messaging. Yeah, that would be sweet.
Oh, now Microsoft's offering $250,000 for interesting research. Facebook has joined, I think, I'm not sure if Microsoft offers a cash reward. I know Google do, but Facebook's launched a bug bounty program, which looks pretty interesting. Compensation starts at $500 and runs up to whatever, basically depending on the nature of the bug. These guys can get paid as long as they don't disclose this research publicly. But you'd have to think, some of the more interesting web-based bugs would also be of interest to the types of organizations that are buying O'Day now, which is intelligence agencies and governments. You'd have to think that they're going to start buying these sorts of bugs as well. So the bug bounty might be made a little bit meaningless. Oh, the other thing to note here too is that Facebook is actually allowing security researchers to set up test accounts. This is interesting.
Yeah, and now that is a smart move. Playing a bug bounty is cool. $500 for a cross-site scripting, I suppose, is better than nothing. And obviously, the reward, as you said, the reward does go up from there. Maybe they'll avoid, the next 2 worms out of 10 because someone sells them a bug. And that, from their point of view, would be a good move. I think, every worm that they can avoid is a good one. But that is cool. Being allowed to set up test accounts, I think, is a very important thing, because that's one of the key problems with this kind of software as a service hosted system, is that there is no legitimate way to test it other than in live and prod. You can't download it like you can a copy of OpenSSH and read the source. Mm-hmm. So being able to legitimately set up test accounts and have somewhere to play, I think, that is a very important thing for us to have some confidence in these kind of, SaaS platforms going forward.
SaaS. Well, you didn't want to say cloud, did you? I love it.
I didn't want to say cloud, but I did say going forward. So,
you just totally ruined it. You're right.
I did. I absolutely ruined it.
Well, hang on. Oh, what can I say?
There's just nothing. There's nothing you can say that will make that better.
Maybe I can say something worse. I can slip the word synergy in somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Maybe if you could synergize something. Maybe you could architect your synergies.
Oh, that'd work. Oh, God, I'm getting the full body cringe right now.
Architecturalize your synergies.
Moving on to a series of stories about Android now. We're just going to cover them very quickly. Apparently, there's been some sort of browser flaw. It's a universal cross-site scripting bug. Looks pretty interesting. Apparently, it's been patched in versions 2.3.5 and 3. I don't even know how the version numbers for this stuff actually works, but apparently
not like it matters, because no one's going to patch their Android anyway.
Well, that's right. But yeah, apparently looks like a fairly interesting bug. But Adam, why don't you explain the details? Because I'd struggle.
Yeah, I actually haven't read the specific technical details of this bug, but yeah, it was described as a universal cross-site script attack that allows you to inject code into the browser or into things that are being returned through the browser API on the phone, which, in theory means that you can man in the middle, the usual sort of internet banking, all the sort of things people are doing from their phones these days. And that's clearly a bad thing, and especially given the amount of fielded Android devices that are going to remain unpatched.
Yeah,
for the foreseeable future.
And speaking of which, the headline from another CNET story says Android users are twice as likely to see malware than they were 6 months ago.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. It claims that there's some fairly large proportion of Android users are getting malware, which, if you were a mobile antivirus vendor, finally after 10 years of saying it's going to happen, finally it is happening, they must be real happy about that. But the thing that concerns me about this study is whilst it says all the things that I want people to hear, specifically that mobile malware is becoming a real threat, it comes from a company that makes a product called Lookout, which is some kind of mobile AV product, as I understand it. And so they're taking telemetry from their user base to generate these stats. And of course, that's kind of a self-selecting sample. Like, the sort of people who would install a security product on their Android phone
are the sort of people who are likely to have been hosed by malware in the first place?
Possibly, yeah. So it just doesn't really seem like a particularly useful set of stats, other than overall, we should probably care about mobile malware. But yeah, in terms of the actual numbers, I don't know that it's that meaningful.
Now, there was another piece that circulated fairly widely around the media saying that an Android Trojan records your phone conversations and oh no's. It was quite interesting, actually, because Symantec came out and poured a big bucket of water on it. That hasn't made the same sort of splash. Ha, ha, ha.
I see what you did
there. You see what I did?
Yeah, very nice.
That's
good.
But apparently this virus works really well in the emulator, but when you put it on an actual device, it doesn't work so good. You need physical access to the device to remove the recordings, and it's like nowhere in the wild. So this whole story is bullshit.
Pretty much bunk, yeah. Although I thought, the most amusing thing that comes out of this is absolutely that, the virus works great in the emulator and fails completely on real hardware. That's just the Android ecosystem in a nutshell, isn't it?
And you know who's been hyping this research, don't you?
It's CA. Really?
Yeah.
Absolute bunch of losers.
But that's all right. Look, the pressure's on everyone to actually get the headlines these days. So, But way to go, Symantec, for actually going, nuh-uh.
Yeah, which is good, especially given that they are an AV vendor. Although I suppose nothing like, screwing over CA for a bit of fun. I would do that if I was Symantec too.
Symantec keep doing stuff lately to make me like them. Like, all that Stuxnet research they did and now this. Stop it.
Yeah. It is. It's nice, actually. Go Symantec. And I guess, I don't know what McAfee's up to these. Now they've been bought by Intel, whether they're going to do anything useful. But
That's our next interview. Adam Boileau, that is the end of this week's news segment. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. We'll see you then.
Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Now it's time for this week's feature, which is all about the so-called Operation Shady Rat, as uncovered by McAfee. McAfee researchers apparently discovered a CNC channel for a botnet they say is obviously the work of state-sponsored spooks. It had infected around 70 organizations over a five-year period, everything from defense contractors to real estate firms and Olympic committees. Now, the report seems to me to intend to describe this botnet as merely being an example of the types of targeted intrusions that are occurring on a daily basis. In fact, the preface to the report, written by McAfee Vice President Dmitry Alperovitk, that's a hard one to pronounce, reads, I am convinced that every company in every conceivable industry with significant size and valuable intellectual property and trade secrets has been compromised or will be shortly, with the great majority of the victims rarely discovering the intrusion or its impact. Now, it sounds alarmist, but it's something that we've been saying on Risky Business for quite some time. So, in other words, even by their own metric, uncovering a botnet of around 70 compromised targets is just something you'd expect to see in this sort of threat environment. The report even has a go at InfoSec companies for messing with the meaning of APT through their marketing campaigns. So the paper itself isn't actually claiming that Shady Rat, of course, RAT capitalized for remote access tool or Trojan. The paper doesn't claim that Shady Rat is a particularly massive deal. Yet there's been a pretty significant backlash within the information security community on this one. Symantec even published its own analysis called The Truth About Shady Rat that concluded that this event is actually pretty run-of-the-mill. Imperva published something similar. So why the backlash? Well, I think I can trace it to McAfee's decision to give a pre-release briefing on the botnet to the magazine Vanity Fair, which dutifully wrote up the story as if this Shady Rat thing is an unprecedented cyber attack that, quote, ranks with Aurora. Now, I believe that article set the tone for the rest of the media coverage we saw on this paper, including, for example, Gizmodo calling it the biggest case of cyber espionage in history. And this is just what happens. The media doesn't have a good grip on these issues. And once an article like that is published by a reputable source like Vanity Fair, everyone else just sort of falls into line and follows suit instead of properly investigating the event they're reporting on and trying to actually set it in the correct context because, that takes work. It didn't help that McAfee's report was only 14 pages long and contained very little concrete technical information and just a bunch of sort of pretty infographics. But really, at the end of the day, and I know, and even McAfee knows, that this thing is just a very small part of something much bigger. And I'm just not sure that this is a distinction that's even relevant for a mainstream audience. It's probably lost on them, but it sure pissed off a lot of people in InfoSec. Now, Shady Rat is a fairly trivial botnet by current standards, and that's pretty significant in itself. We shouldn't lose sight of that just because some of us don't approve of the media's coverage of this event or the way McAfee has maneuvered to commercialize this research. Now, I thought it would be a good idea to actually speak to someone from McAfee to answer some questions that were left unanswered by this report, because it's really light on detail. So I spoke to McAfee Australia's Sean Duker, and I started off by asking him to tell us why McAfee thought this was a state-sponsored threat in the first place.
This specific type of, I guess, botnet was more focused around the malware that was being used. It was only reporting back to one specific command and control service. So it wasn't multiple command and control servers that were being used. So we're not saying that it's a particular person, could be a number of different people, but from what we seem to believe, there's just one specific command and control server rather than sort of multiple being used.
Okay. And was there any evidence of actual, because the paper refers to logs, was there any evidence of actual data exfiltration? Because it's really not spelled out in the paper.
So we can see from the information that we've gathered in terms of our investigation post obviously sort of going through the logs and still combing through the logs at the moment, we've been working with some of the organisations, and that's where we've seen that some information has obviously left, and that's where we've been able to get a little bit granular to find out, you know, specifically what we've seen leave the organisation.
And what sort of stuff did you see? I mean, obviously I'm not asking for specifics, but what sort of stuff did you actually see leaving via this malware?
So we've seen everything from source code, bugs, email information sort of going out the door as well. From other types of investigations that we've done, we've seen obviously bid information going through the door.
Bid information?
So in terms of sort of competitive bids, so people placing a bid for an example I used from a previous one being the Night Dragon. You know, we saw oil and gas bids being sort of placed by large, you know, multinationals to go for a specific, you know, exploration bid or something like that.
Okay.
A drilling bid.
And how was it that you were actually able to ascertain that information was leaving?
So it was just by going through and doing a forensic examination of, you know, what systems were compromised and sort of doing that whole audit trail to find out from there with what went outside the organisation.
So you had the information that was actually on, was that just information that was on the systems, or did you actually find evidence that the information had been exfiltrated?
Bit of both.
A bit of both. Okay.
Yep.
So how would you go about establishing which specific bits of info actually left as opposed to which bits of information were on a compromised host?
So it's sometimes you can put a bit of an assumption as to what may have gone out the door. If you end up finding out that, let's say that the malware was actually used, or the malware that was used in some of these specific attacks, if that was actually found on, you know, let's say five of the key systems inside an organization, and from there, the people that use those systems have access to XYZ, other, you know, databases or whatever it may be, you can pretty much ascertain from there that, well, if they've got access to here, then more than likely they would have been able to start spreading inside the organization, get access to, you know, other pieces.
See, I guess that's what I'm trying to work out here, is whether or not this malware was just on systems that contained this information, or whether McAfee has concrete evidence to support the assertion that that data was actually exfiltrated. It sounds like what you're saying is that the data was there, the people had access to this information, therefore it's likely that that information was exfiltrated. But there's no actual log evidence, is there?
Log evidence as well.
Okay. In all of those cases, or just some cases? Or
I don't have the fine details as to what specifically, but from what I do know, we've definitely got information, detailed information as to what was taken.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it wasn't in the report. Lots of infographics.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I guess another question I'm curious about, and you probably see where I'm going with this, right, which is that there's an awful lot of malware out there that affects an awful lot of organizations, and there's 70 organizations that are highlighted in the report where you guys have said, well, these guys, you know, obviously have information that's of value to state attackers. Was there a whole bunch of organizations that weren't actually particularly interesting who are also affected by this malware? Did it pop up at, say, you know, Aunt Betty's, you know, craft store and stuff like that? Was it fairly widely distributed stuff?
It was widely distributed in the sense that it's probably the first time that we've seen it to this scale, where it's not specifically targeting, you know, let's say your typical government organizations, or in the case of Aurora, it was all your high-tech Googles and Adobes and things like that. This is where it's starting to go into, you know, real estate, agricultural, insurance. You're talking just, you know, typical organizations that people may be working at. When you start spreading that around to say, well, it's the same person that's going across government, going across, you know, large industry, going across, you know, a various different range of verticals, you start to map the picture out. Well, they're not specifically just going for, you know, what are the US government or what's someone else doing around the world. It's more a case of, you know, what are people doing? What potential information do they have? And let me try and get that information as well. So, and that's what makes it a little bit more different.
So what do we know about the infection vector here? Because if it sounds like something that perhaps has just gone out there, maybe, you know, maybe what, drive-by downloads, that sort of thing, pretty arbitrary sort of infection vector.
From what we've seen, it's spear phishing attacks that have been used to actually gain access to a targeted system. So, you know, the traditional sort of mechanisms of social engineering of trying to trick someone.
Because we've seen that in the case of, say, after Salesforce.com got compromised a few years ago, there was a massive opportunistic spear phishing campaign directed against their customers. They got the correct sort of account representative and, you know, account number and all of that, and emailed all of these accounts people with, here is your invoice. And a lot of the time it was just executables. And then they were able to leverage that access. And of course, because they're infecting people in accounts, they were doing some pretty impressive fraud. I think one of the companies affected was a payroll firm, and they just started adding phantom employees, which was a pretty nifty way of doing it. Kudos to them. But what do we know of the actual level of information in those spear phishers? Is it a case that it was directed? Was it sort of standard sort of phishing stuff, or how tailored was it?
So they were definitely targeted. I don't have details as to specifically what was in those emails or what type of attachments they were to. You know, to lure people to actually sort of double-click on the attachment as an example, but they were definitely targeted spear phishing targets.
Do we know why this information wasn't included in the report? Because it is, as I say, it's what, like a 10 or 12-page report or something like that, and it seems quite thin on these sorts of details, and yet, you know, we're seeing the media run with this as if it's an operation in scale that rivals Aurora.
It is. So I think information will be shared in the future around this one, but why it wasn't included in the report, I'm not too sure.
Yeah. And have you been surprised to see it written up as, you know, world's largest cyber attack sort of thing? Because it reads like it's the discovery of a fairly run-of-the-mill botnet, the type of botnet that you would just discover these days.
Not really, no. So I wouldn't even sort of classify it as your typical sort of botnet either. More because of the fact that, one, obviously, people are getting impacted by malware. You know, any type of organization potentially could get impacted by malware. But when we start to see that over large periods of time, people are connecting to these organizations and data is actually leaving those organizations, and then having worked with those organizations to find out, well, you know, what may have actually taken place, and let's start to drill down and do that forensic examination, that's when we start to find, you know, the scale of it is not just simply, you know, it's like a configure where there's, you know, a total of 3 million systems that have been compromised that are all acting as part of, you know, a large spam campaign or denial of service attack. This is more around how do we actually start to attack a specific organization and take specific information out of it and send it to a third-party organization. That's where it's a little bit different to, you know, your run-of-the-mill botnet.
So what do you say to those who say, well, what's happened here is McAfee has found a CNC channel that is obviously, you know, controlling malware that's doing some pretty interesting stuff, and they've seen that it's been successful in infecting a number of these interesting organizations.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to them like you've cherry-picked the ones that actually hold valuable information and then come up with this thesis that it's a state.
Not at all. So the thing that makes it interesting is, from what we've seen from this specific attack, 70 organizations were targeted. It's not a case of, you know, thousands upon thousands, and we've just decided to choose the good 70, so to speak.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at earlier. I mean, but has Aunt Betty been caught up in this as well, or is it just those 70 organizations?
Just those 70, and that's what we're reporting on.
Okay, right. So it is. There were no infections using this particular type of malware.
Correct.
Outside of those 70 organizations.
And the thing that's different about it is it's not a specific type of malware that's being used. So it's not a case of, hey, you know, if you download the latest update to McAfee's antivirus, all of a sudden you're going to be sort of protected. It's more around this was a targeted campaign. Various different types of malware was being used to, compromise hosts and then start to exfiltrate the data out. So,
but they were all running through the same CNC chain.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, Sean Duca from McAfee. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
McAfee's Sean Duca on the line there, discussing McAfee's research paper on the Shady Rat botnet. And big thanks to Sean for giving up some of his time to explain those details and clear up some of those gaps. We do not intend for this report to be a wholesale punch in the face for McAfee. And if you'd like to actually see some more detailed technical analysis, Google for that semantic analysis, The Truth Behind Shady Rat. There's some interesting detail in there, like they were using Stego, like embedded messages in images and stuff to do stealthy command and control. So there's some bits of it that were sophisticated, some bits that weren't. Interesting and worth a read. And that's that story. Okay, now it's time for this week's sponsor interview, and we're chatting with Marcus Ranham, security legend Marcus Ranham, who is Chief Security Officer of our wonderful sponsor, Tenable Network Security. And we're chatting to him about the United States' brand spanking new cyber war doctrine, which was released, I think it was just a few weeks ago. We've heard many times US policymakers say cyber attacks may be met with conventional military responses like airstrikes. And now it's official. And that could present some problems, particularly around attribution. Marcus Ranham has been watching developments in the area, the so-called cyber war area. He's been watching them quite attentively for quite some time and spoken at various conferences on his thoughts. And he joined me by phone to have a chat about this new doctrine.
Okay, well, the Pentagon released this, I believe it was July 14th or so. Basically, it's a bunch of stuff that creates additional agency structures of who's responsible for what. And depending on how you want to interpret it, it's a further ratification or enlargement of NSA's role in cybersecurity for government agencies. Yeah, they're basically the lead agency on that, I think.
And so what are the fundamental tenets of this thing? What is new in it? Apart from just those sort of agency restructuring, I mean, is there anything about, doctrine?
The main piece of doctrine that comes out that's fairly interesting was quoted by one of the spokesmen whose name eludes me right now. Basically, the interesting piece to me was the idea that physical attacks, military operations are not taken off the table in response to a cyber war attack. So basically, the Department of Defense has said, if you're able to hurt the United States badly enough with a cyber attack, we may bomb you or invade you.
Now, we've heard that before coming from various spokespeople from the United States government. I guess the thing that makes this new is that now it's in an actual official policy document. Is that really what's new about this?
Yeah, that's what's new. In the past, what we were hearing was people saying, these options are on the table. Now it's, these options are on the table, but they're decidedly on the table. it's not just, well, we're going to think about it. It's now that's part of our workflow in deciding how we're going to deal with you.
This is the plan, basically, now.
Yeah, it's a planning option. That's a good way of looking at it. Everything is on the table, which is very interesting. And the reason this concerns me, and I've been worried about this for a long time, is because it doesn't really say anything about attribution, which I think is absolutely crucial. I think that if we're going to say that we may launch physical attacks against you, I would have liked to have seen some kind of statement about a process for how we're going to explain to the rest of the world that we're justified in doing this.
But Marcus, as tricky as attribution is, and we all know that it's very difficult, do you think that a country like the United States would actually go with a conventional response unless they were very, very confident of attribution, unless they had really solid intelligence? Or is that what you think needs to be spelled out in the document?
That is exactly what I think needs to be spelled out. Let me kind of ramble forth for a little bit about this and some ideas. We saw that incident where the North Koreans allegedly sank this South Korean ship, the Cheonan, with 40 people or so on board using a torpedo. And there was a question initially, you know, the North Koreans were suspected of having done this. And what we wound up seeing was an international commission assembled in which the evidence was examined and presented by, I think, the U.S., Australia, Canada, and Sweden were involved. So it was a multinational assessment of the evidence. That's where we saw that report where they basically said, well, you know, it's extremely suspicious. We did find torpedo parts. We did find, you know.
With made in North Korea written on them.
Yeah, that's kind of suspicious, you know. But the reason that this is important, and of course, it didn't really resolve anything because the suspects on the quote other side end quote all said, ah, that's fake, right? But I think that that's a really good model for how this kind of thing should be done going forward. When you compare it with the kinds of things we have seen in the past, where you'll basically get some government agency saying, well, those were Chinese IP addresses. Right. And that's the crucial point about this, is that we didn't see a clarification that the United States was going to say, if we're going to declare something to be an act of war, essentially we're unilaterally going to say, we think this was an act of war, we're going to launch physical attacks against you because it's our opinion that you did it. That's an extremely dangerous precedent, and I'm afraid that's the precedent that it looks like is being set. And what, you know, what I would love to see is, I don't know where this would come from, maybe the United Nations, maybe from some treaty partners, basically saying, look, if you're going to do that, we would like to see some kind of a process where there's a multinational assessment of the evidence before anybody gets killed. I mean, we're moving to an era now where, you know, he said, she said about syslogs could get somebody killed.
Then again, Marcus, you're not really making a case that the attribution in a general military sense is actually any better than what we're describing in the cyber sense. Go back to the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War really escalated after, I think, some boat belonging to one side was actually apparently torpedoed around Vietnam, and then it turned into a major incident. I think in retrospect, actually, it turned out that boat may have just struck a reef or something like that. So the entire escalation of the Vietnam War was based on an incorrect assumption involving attribution. So why is it that you feel that we should do a better job of it when it comes to the cyber case, when we're doing such a terrible job of it when it comes to conventional military responses?
Well, you raised an absolutely fantastic point. I mean, what you're talking about there is the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And the way that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was initially reported was that U.S. ships were taken under fire by North Korea. North. But yeah, no, it was NVA basically fired on an American ship. And what we now know absolutely categorically was that that was a friendly fire incident. That was the U.S. Navy firing on itself by accident. But our political leaders who knew that this was a friendly fire incident. Again, it is indisputable that they knew this was a friendly fire incident, promoted that as a casus belli to go to war. Okay? Now, the reason this is important is because we have another clear case in which, 50,000 Americans, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese and completely uninvolved Cambodians were killed.
Actually, the number was Vietnam. The casualty in Vietnam on the Vietnamese side was actually 3.42 million deaths, and that figure comes from Robert S. McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the time. But anyway,
yeah, okay. I was going to say that the snappy comment there would be, well, what does he know, right? but you see my point, right? What's important about this is that now history can additionally heap condemnation on these people. And does that solve anything? No. Does that help in some way? Maybe. I mean, you know, I think it is crucial that we do not commit war crimes because of a bunch of packets that are misattributed.
Okay, but what you're saying here about the Gulf of Tonkin and also about some of this stuff that happened in North Korea is that governments will happily ignore any evidence of attribution And just sort of make up their own attribution if it suits their political and military objectives. So I guess my question is, what's the point of having good attribution if policymakers are just going to ignore it and fabricate it anyway?
Well, I think it's nice for the rest of us to be able to point and say, we know you lied, right? No, that's you know.
Oh,
I'm
no,
serious.
It's deadly serious. I mean, yeah, that's what WikiLeaks has turned out to be for of late, but yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, look at the damage that lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has done to U.S. foreign policy, right? It's going to be very difficult for the United States to establish another coalition of the duped to go and attack and unilaterally attack next time if, you know, God forbid there's a next time. But if somebody tries that again from the United States, we're going to get a lot more scrutiny of the evidence and a lot more skepticism, and there won't be as much support, right? I mean, sure, the British will probably be our lapdogs and go along with it again, but everybody else in the international community will be able to go, hey, you guys have a history here, right?
Hey, I'll we're just interrupt you there to say, look, if the British go in, I mean, we're bigger sycophants than the British. I promise you that.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I wish you guys would stop doing that.
Me too,
Marcus. That's not good. No, here's another really crucial point about the attribution problem. We in the United States need to be creating the best possible and clearest possible path for how to handle this kind of thing. Example is Stuxnet, okay? If what we're saying is that all we need in order to treat something as an act of war is the method and the motive and the opportunity, then we have essentially painted a target on ourselves and said that Iran is completely justified carrying out conventional military operations in retaliation for Stuxnet against the United States or Israel, right? They can say, well, obviously it's one of you two.
Yeah.
So we are now going to carry out kinetic attacks against your infrastructure, or we're going to carry out retaliatory cyber attacks. This is why it's crucial to the United States and other first world powers to get this right and to get it, you know, to establish a process whereby this kind of stuff can be discussed and the evidence can be examined as openly and as honestly as possible, because, you know, we're actually the ones who are the most vulnerable against this kind of thing.
Now, I think if I take what you're saying correctly, it would be that because this is an emerging area of military doctrine, perhaps these issues aren't being taken as seriously as they should be. Am I getting that correct?
I think you're exactly correct. The question, the really interesting question, is why aren't these things being taken as seriously as they should be? Right.
What do you think on that?
Well, I'm afraid that it's inconvenient to take them seriously, right? Mm. We've got this horrible thing where we're trying to have our cake and eat it too, right? We're basically saying, well, you know, we had no involved. Well, actually, has there been a statement that we weren't involved in Stuxnet? I'm not sure.
I don't think it's been denied, but it hasn't been confirmed. It's just there's been a lot of coy sort of smiling and nodding and saying, we don't know anything about that, wink, wink.
Exactly. And unfortunately, many of the responses to Stuxnet from the U.S. and Israel have amounted to, well, it saved you guys a good old bombing now, didn't it? Right? And the problem with that would be, given our current doctrines, I don't see why Iran wouldn't be justified in having intelligence operatives plant plastic explosive on power facilities in the U.S. and say, yeah, Stuxnet that, right? And we're completely justified in doing this. Of course, the problem is this becomes, because it's being left unclear, I think that what's happening is that it becomes simply another way for the strong to inflict their will on the weak. I'm afraid that cyber warfare techniques are going to become kind of like weapons of mass destruction, right? Well, we've got it.
Yeah.
We proliferate it to all of our buddies. But don't you dare proliferate it, because we'll preempt you.
And you get to decide. And you get to decide who's a rogue state and who's a respectable Western power, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that really bothers me, and so that's why, you know, I would love to see the international community responding a little bit more strongly to this U.S. doctrine, saying that's fine, but if you're going to declare something to be an act of war, we would like something better than IP addresses, okay?
Or techniques, or just, you know, your shellcode looks familiar, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because, you know, every time somebody talks about cyber war, this question of misattribution comes up. What if somebody did a false flag operation? You know, there doubtless have been false flag operations in warfare, but I'm more concerned that, you know, as you say, this could be used extremely cynically, like the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Okay, well, Marcus Ranum, it's been fascinating speaking to you about this, which is a topic that, you know, has been done to death, but it's that was a really refreshing take, my friend. Always a pleasure to chat to you, and we'll speak to you again on the show, I'm sure.
Take care.
Marcus Ranum of Tenable Network Security there with a chat about cyber war doctrine, Vietnam, Korea, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And that is it for this week's podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. This week's track is Grape Juice City by independent New York artist Ratatat. Get a copy of this album on iTunes. If you like this track, you know, you're going to love the whole album. I really enjoy it. It's called LP4 and it absolutely kicks ass. It's got like a hint of Aphex Twin synthy stuff in there, but it's friendlier and more accessible and won't make you freak out. Big thanks to Jonathan Werrett for putting me onto these guys. They're really great. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.